College basketball is a billion-dollar business in the United States. Schools see donations and applications rise when their teams win, and angry alumni when they don't. Nowhere is that more true than the basketball-crazed state of Kentucky, where Louisville basketball wasn't just big business, it was and still is an identity for fans.
The University of Louisville is one of the premier programs in the United States. And it has been historically. It is a very large revenue sport. It's bigger than their football team.
At the helm of this program was Hall of Fame coach Rick Pitino, who led the Cardinals to a national championship in 2013. With that success came a lucrative apparel deal and millions flowing into the Louisville Athletic Department every year. But when the university found out its basketball program was being investigated for allegedly paying money to land a new recruit, a commonplace offense in the college ranks, it threatened everything.
There's no doubt that for decades, people have thought, or at least had a feeling, that high-level recruits are being paid somehow, some way.
Over that time, the National Collegiate Athletic Association had been the entity investigating these allegations with mixed results. But Louisville's investigation was different. This time, the FBI was involved.
What they were looking at in the broadest strokes was the connections between shoe companies, money, influence, and everything in between. There's a sense that this was all very interesting. It was possibly sleazy. It was possibly unethical.
This is a story about sports, collusion, wire fraud, and deception. I'm Kate Stetson. This is Proof in Trial, Season 3, University of Louisville. More Americans play basketball than any other team sport. The pressure starts in high school as teams compete to become state champions. At college level, it's even more intense. Teams play throughout the season with the ultimate goal of winning the NCAA championship. If they qualify, they compete in a postseason tournament known as March Madness. I'll let Hogan Lovell's partner and basketball fan, Peter Spivak, explain.
Men's basketball in the United States, especially at the Division I level, is one of the biggest spectator sports in the United States. When I say Division I, the NC2A, which is the National Collegiate Athletics Association, it's a voluntary association of universities and colleges. It's divided up into three divisions, Division I, Division II, and Division III. March Madness is the best teams, 64 best teams in the country, from each of the conferences that play Division I basketball. It's a single elimination tournament. So you have to keep winning. That is, next to the Super Bowl, the biggest TV audience for any sport in the United States.
The Louisville Cardinals are a Division I team and have made regular NCAA tournament appearances over the years. Banners promoting the team can be seen all over campus, which is spread across the historic downtown area. Located on Main Street and across from the Ohio River waterfront is the university's multi-purpose arena and home to the Cardinals. The modern building sits prominently along the city's skyline and is one of the biggest venues in college basketball. Large-scale concerts are also held there. Everyone from Justin Bieber to Metallica has taken the stage. But according to Hogan Lovell's partner Ben Fleming, it's the men's basketball team that keeps fans coming back for more.
They're the biggest game in town. That's a really top-level atmosphere for a collegiate player if the team is performing well. And for most of the time we're talking about, the team was one of, if not the most successful programs in the country.
Louisville has a rich history in sport. It's home to the Kentucky Derby, Muhammad Ali, and the Louisville Slugger, the official bat used in Major League Baseball. There has always been a lot of appetite for high-level competition, and the Cardinals don't disappoint. The enthusiasm for basketball is palpable, and players get a lot of recognition. There's also the financial perks.
Well, it's the area where you see scholarships for athletes, where you see apparel companies sponsoring men's basketball teams So they will wear logos on their uniforms. They'll wear shoes from those apparel companies. Those contracts are very lucrative for the premier teams.
Sponsorship of a team by an apparel company is common in Division I basketball. It's a branding opportunity for companies looking to associate themselves with top athletes who have a serious chance of moving on to a professional team.
Men's basketball is really, really significant as a sport. It is also the pathway to the National Basketball Association, the professional league, and of course, international leagues as well. So players who participate are usually on scholarship. They have to play at least a year, and then they can go into the professional league. So it's also a feeder for the professional leagues in the United States and in international.
The pressure for colleges to recruit the best players is intense, and competition can be fierce. Over the years, there have been whispers that some prospective players might be getting paid or encouraged by other financial means to attend a specific university. Hogan Lovell's partner Neil Katyal talks us through it.
For years, many, including those at the NCAA, have suspected that there were people essentially bribing prospective players with financial or other incentives to play for a particular team. But they were just rumors and very hard to prove. No one had been able to gather concrete evidence that this was indeed the case. It was all very hush-hush, but it was certainly possible.
While those pay-for-play rumors had been circulating for years, it wasn't until the FBI began to investigate and gather evidence that it became a much more serious issue.
It's really hard to prove things like this. Money sloshes around in the system, and it goes into nooks and crannies and disappears. What was different this time was the FBI had wiretaps set up. This was a situation where the FBI was actually listening in. And that was new and different. That was the sort of evidence that would tend to make people sit up and notice. It certainly is the sort of thing that the FBI does when they're interested in winning a case in court.
The Louisville Cardinals were one of six programs being investigated. Then, on September 26th, 2017, the government made a series of arrests.
They finally had the proof they needed. The FBI executed arrest warrants, and those warrants were based on those suspected of providing monetary payments and other things of value to high-level recruits. That money was going primarily to players' families, but also to non-scholastic basketball coaches, that is, AAU coaches, to try to convince these athletes to attend schools that were associated with these apparel companies.
For Louisville, the charges were based on a complaint that a consultant at an apparel company conspired to pay $100,000 to a recruit's family in exchange for him to play for the university. If true, this would make him ineligible. I'll let Peter give us the details.
The theory was the NC2A, it's an amateur athletics association, so it has very detailed rules about amateurism, what affects amateurism, and what can make a player ineligible. Ineligibility is very significant because if you have an ineligible player who receives a scholarship and who plays in a postseason tournament, whether it's a conference tournament or an NC2A tournament, that player essentially makes the school have to potentially vacate any wins associated with that player, potentially take down any conference championship or postseason championship banners, and return revenues. Then there's also a reputational hit because there's a lot of interest in the news media in the United States in men's basketball. Those transgressions, whether even if in completely innocent from the school's standpoint, they get publicized and they affect recruitment and they affect booster participation, that is the alumni and others who contribute money to the athletic department because they're fans of Louisville basketball. So it has a lot of consequences.
The case was heard in the Southern District of New York. The charges centered around consultants at an apparel company. The theory was that they had defrauded Louisville and other schools by the payments they had made to athletes. They had also induced recruits to make false statements to the universities all of which meant those players were considered ineligible to compete.
The government's case was that this was wire fraud. The folks who were secretly working to pay these players had rendered them ineligible and defrauded the university out of its resources and its decision, its ability to control what happened with its own recruits by this secret effort. Louisville and other schools helped in the case. They testified at trial. They provided cooperation. Documents explained the situation. They played a not insignificant role in securing convictions at trial. The jury found the collaborators guilty. At sentencing, the judge specifically noted the extent to which Louisville and the other affected institutions were the victims of this scheme.
University officials were relieved it was finally over, and everyone was looking forward to moving on. But that relief was short-lived.
It was only after the criminal convictions had been secured and Louisville had been cooperating for quite a bit of time that the NCAA entered the picture.
Their view was quite different than the government's view. The government saw Louisville as a victim, and that's what the jury found in sustaining the convictions. But on the NCAA's account, Louisville was on the hook for what the apparel sponsor employees and consultants had been doing, because they had a commercial relationship, and by seeking to steer recruits to Louisville, the employees were working on the university's behalf, and the university could be held accountable.
As part of their response, the NCAA formed a commission headed by former U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and issued a report on how to handle potential violations going forward.
That commission report recommended a series of changes and enhancements, really, in the way the whole NCAA enforcement process worked. But it also focused on the role of apparel companies and talking about the enormous sums that apparel companies use to sponsor, to promote their brand at various different levels, including high school and collegiate level. And that really was about, look, there's so much money involved here. If the NCAA is really trying to preserve its amateurism and its really for the benefit of the game and for fair competition, the role of the apparel companies needs to be examined.
As a result, the NCAA adopted the Independent Accountability Resolution Process, or IARP for short. The IARP was intended to essentially take complicated cases out of the NCAA process and instead hold an independent and objective investigation into potential violations. In this case, the NCAA believed the universities should have seen this pay-for-play scheme coming and done more to prevent it.
The NCAA tends to take the position that universities are really in a position where if there's a violation, whether or not they knew, maybe they should have known of the conduct. They decided in this case that each of the universities should essentially go through an enforcement proceeding where the theory was that with very specific, detailed allegations, there were NC2 violations that occurred.
The IARP was one that universities can opt into. There were serious considerations at play, specifically the amount of time and resources this would take. Essentially, the case starts all over again. But despite the further delays, Louisville agreed to opt in.
The University of Louisville and other universities said, you know, we want to go through this IARP process because we want an objective view. We don't really understand, frankly, how we can be victims of a plot to conceal violations from us on the one hand, and on the other, according to the NCAA, be a guilty party and responsible for what we didn't know about. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
At this point, officials at the University of Louisville reached out to Hogan Lovells for help. Neil Katyal, Peter Spivak, and Ben Fleming had all worked with the university before, and they led the Hogan Lovells team throughout the hearing. Louisville was facing several Tier 1 violations, which would have major ramifications on the program if they were found guilty.
So a level one violation is considered the most serious breach of NCAA rules possible. And a level one violation can trigger significant penalties, including, among other things, bans on competing in postseason tournaments, restrictions on the number of scholarships a school can offer its student athletes. And level one penalties are particularly troublesome if there's a pattern or history of them. And here, Louisville was facing that risk. The NCAA ultimately claimed that there were five different level one violations at play. And the presence of more than one in a single case has weight, and the timing has weight too.
The Hogan Lovells team started to sift through all the evidence and build their case. But before they could even get started, new allegations surfaced.
The focus had all been on the time period of the men's basketball program under Coach Rick Pitino. When the scandal came out, he and the university parted ways in 2018. And so there was a new basketball coach, Chris Mack, who was hired.
As with any new coach, Coach Mack was eager to make changes. And in doing so, he ruffled a few feathers.
And so he told several of his assistant coaches that they wouldn't get their contracts renewed. And in fact, they'd leave at the end of the season. Well, one of those coaches didn't react well, to say the least. So what he did is he came in to Coach Mack's office, and Coach Mack actually ended up recording this meeting on his iPhone, unbeknownst to the assistant coach. And the assistant coach threatened him. And he said, look, if you don't pay me the salary remaining on my contract, which was about a year and a half, several hundred thousand dollars, I am going to go to the NCAA and I'm going to report violations under your program. Well, Coach Mack did the right thing in that he immediately notified the university. And the university, in turn, notified the FBI and notified the NCAA. And basically said, look, you know, this, here's a phone recording. This looks like a possible extortion. So the FBI investigated. That assistant coach ended up getting charged and pleading guilty to federal crimes.
When that assistant coach was interviewed by the CCU, or the Complex Case Unit, at the IARP, he told them about violations he thought were occurring under Coach Mack. They centered around student managers who participated in drills for time periods that were against the NCAA rules, as well as videos that were being used to help recruit potential players.
And so these were added as new allegations to the CCU's case. And so we really had these two time periods, the Coach Pitino time period and the Coach Mack time period. And so Neil Katyal and I decided that what we do is, in approaching the case, we kind of divided it in two because we had two different eras. And so Neil would focus on the Coach Pitino era, I would focus on the Coach Mack era. So that added several years to the whole process. So by the time we went to hearing, it was June 2022, when this had really started in 2017.
The three-day hearing started on a Friday in what can only be described as an interesting location. I'll let Ben get into the details.
The hearing was held in a ballroom in a hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Underground level, so beneath the street. Big cavernous space, and it was the type of place you can just imagine a high school prom being set up in. I had flashbacks to all sorts of high school events, and I vaguely imagined my parents picking me up out front of the hotel. It was just that type of scene. So if you can imagine in a room that big, everyone was very spread out. The panel was sitting on risers, almost like a dais, off to one long side of the room. The lawyers were arranged around in a semicircle, but we were 100 feet almost from the lawyers who were working on the case from the NCAA side. Could barely make out facial features sometimes. There were microphones everywhere, giant speakers in the corner. I've never been in a room quite like that doing a trial.
The five people who sat on the panel had a diverse but relevant mix of backgrounds. The purpose was to try to get panelists who understood college athletics and had an appreciation of the issues.
Our panel was made up of people who had both legal experience and experience either as athletes themselves or participants in athletic decision-making or administration. So we had an arbitrator for the World Anti-Doping Association. We had a former NFL player. We had a law professor. We had a general counsel for an NBA team. And we had a mediator who had also been an Olympic hopeful in figure skating.
The panel asked detailed questions to all sides in order to fully understand the various allegations. And answering the questions, the NCAA's legal team began to shift their argument.
So the trickiest thing was the NCAA would pull out a new piece of evidence from the voluminous record, and we'd have to scramble and adjust. So that meant quickly coordinating on what's our message, where does this fit into what we've already done, and going back and forth between me and Neil and me and Peter and all of us on how to phrase it, and just doing what you do at trial, which is writing things down on pieces of paper and passing them around, and then someone eventually says them out loud not too long after the thought has flown into someone's head.
The main argument from the Coach Pitino case was whether or not the apparel company that sponsored the Cardinals could be considered a booster. Let me explain. According to the NCAA, a booster is someone who plays a role in supporting student athletes and sports programs through donations of time and financial resources.
A school can be held accountable for what its boosters do in some instances without the school having advanced knowledge of what's happening. The basic idea is you don't want to have people affiliated in some sense with an institution going out and doing things that the university or an athletics program itself clearly could not do. So institutions have obligations to monitor known boosters and provide rules education to them, so those boosters know what NCAA rules do and do not permit.
The Hogan-Lovells team argued that just because a school had a sponsorship agreement with an apparel company, it didn't make that company a booster.
The CCU's theory was that the apparel company's representative either assisted in the recruiting process or was promoting the university's athletics program, or both. Our argument was that the apparel company wasn't a booster and it wasn't assisting in recruitment, but instead acting in its own financial interests. It was also not promoting the university's program, it was instead promoting its own brand. And the whole notion that they're a booster and that somehow the University of Louisville should be able to control the actions of a multinational corporation is quite simply a farce. It's nonsensical.
When the panel got to the Coach Mack issues, the CCU argument was that he was using student managers to run drills with his athletes. The managers were athletes themselves, many of whom had played varsity basketball or internationally. The CCU argued the length of time these managers spent on the court during training was against the NCAA rules and gave the University of Louisville an unfair advantage.
We had 2 points in response. The first was, let's just look at the rule. Well, the rule is confusing to say the least, because the rule allows managers to participate in drills on a regular basis in a limited manner. But it doesn't say what a regular basis is, and it doesn't say what a limited manner is. So our argument was, first of all, the rule's vague. And if you're going to impose liability on the university, then you should have clear rules. That seems like a basic position and a basic principle. The second thing is, let's actually look at the tapes. We also were able to quantify the time of participation, and the quantification really showed that there was less than of total of allowable practice time, less than 4 or 5% of that time was time where the graduate managers were participating.
The CCU's second argument was in regards to the videos and itineraries that Coach Mack showed potential recruits when they visited the university. Both included the recruit's picture, which the CCU claims created another unfair advantage. Peter disagreed.
In this day and age, anybody can pick up an iPhone and make a movie. So it really is not something that affects the competitive landscape, which is the real concern. And then when they looked at the itineraries, they said, you know, this seems, first of all, allowable within the rules, but it's also kind of an absurd allegation in and of itself, because you're literally talking about a person's likeness with a schedule. And part of the purpose that we put out was, it's pretty important when a student athlete who's being recruited from a number of schools comes to campus and they meet with the head coach. The head coach needs to know what they look like. And the athletics director needs to know what they look like. The athlete who's in control of the decision is going to go to the school where he thinks he fits in best. They go to a program where they like the coach. They go to the program where they're going to get minutes because there's an available spot. That is why athletes choose schools. Not because they get an 8.5 by 11 printed piece of paper with their picture on it. You know, it sort of defies logic again.
The hearing ended on a Sunday in June, but it would be months before a decision would be made.
So we wrapped, and there was a sense of anticlimax because we knew we were not going to know the result for a significant period of time. We didn't know how long, but we knew that there would be a written decision and we would have maybe a day's notice that it was coming. It took something like 4 months after that was over for us to get a whiff of a decision.
The waiting was hard for all parties. The Louisville basketball program had been fighting these allegations for years, and there had been a cloud of uncertainty hanging over the team. They were eager to move on.
This was something that was clearly of paramount importance to the university. They'd been living with it for 5 years. And when I say living with it, I mean it was weighing over the entire program. It's not the sort of thing that goes unnoticed, right? Other schools would use this as ammunition during the recruiting process, saying, do you really want to go to Louisville when they're facing these NCAA charges and you might not be able to compete in the NCAA tournament? Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but we don't have these charges hanging over our head. We're not going to be banned from postseason play, as far as you know. Come to us.
There was a lot of media attention surrounding the case, and the date and timing of the decision had to be considered. Finally, in October, the team at Hogan Lovells were told the decision will be released to the public the following morning. The team had about 24 hours to digest it before the press conferences began.
After they've selected that date and everyone's coordinated what they need to coordinate, we get an update that says the decision's going to be released publicly at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. You'll see it at 8. There'll be a press conference at 10. And that's when the university finds out about it, too. And they're going to want to make a public statement no matter what the result is. So you find out on about 24 hours notice that the next day is going to be full of discussion and debate and analysis. And that's how it ended up playing out. We got the update, everyone geared up to read the next morning, and then 100 plus page decision drops into your inbox. And within a few hours, it's going to be on ESPN.
For the University of Louisville, it was good news. The IARP agreed that the school was a victim of the scheme, and instead of implementing severe sanctions, the program was placed on probation for 2 years and fined $5,000. It was a big day for Louisville.
So the decision was hugely important because it essentially cleared the university of all the most serious violations, any one of which could have resulted in a penalty that would have impacted the program adversely. For me personally, I found this really a fascinating process. A great result, you know, just a wonderful team to work with. Neil's leadership was fantastic. It was really fun. The university was a wonderful client to have and a wonderful client to work with.
And it was a great experience working along Peter Spivak and the team. Peter's among the best lawyers I've ever worked with. And after it all was over, the university was finally able to move on without any uncertainty hanging over their heads. They're happy to finally focus on the task at hand, which is playing ball in an exceptional way and giving fans the rich experience they deserve.
You can find more information about our litigation team at HoganLovells.com. I hope you'll join us for the next episode of Proof in Trial. Until next time, I'm Kate Stetson.